This is the NPR News Update. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. It's Friday, January 21st. I'm John Wanamaker. Problems with MinSure's website have been widely reported. The technology may seem new, but a similar problem has plagued the state in the past. The Pawlenty administration tried to create a software system that would electronically check the eligibility of people applying for certain state health programs. MinSure's software is supposed to perform the same function, but has run into major problems. As Elizabeth Stowicki reports, critics say the state failed to learn important lessons from that initial multi-million-dollar failure.
Before there was MinSure, there was HealthMatch.
That was a complete failure.
Longtime state representative Tom Huntley, a DFLer from Duluth.
We hired a company to manage it and, you know, set it up, and nothing ever happened.
The HealthMatch project dragged on for 5 years and spent more than $20 million of taxpayer money for development. The Office of Legislative Auditor, Jim Nobles, monitored the HealthMatch project, and Nobles said the state got nothing out of it except valuable experience.
The one thing we could have gotten of value are lessons. And so when I look at MinSure, I just don't necessarily see that people are applying lessons of what not to do.
One of MinSure's central functions is to determine if someone qualifies for Minnesota Care. The software is supposed to verify a person's income, review eligibility requirements nearly instantaneously. But the code was a mess. And in December, Governor Mark Dayton blasted IBM for delivering a defective product that did not properly determine eligibility. And it was the second time in less than a decade that a computerized eligibility system had been a big, expensive flop. Back in 2003, the Pawlenty administration took up an idea conceived during the Ventura administration. The state contracted with SSI North America to produce HealthMatch. HealthMatch was supposed to apply digital precision to the eligibility process and bring down a high error rate on Minnesota Care's determinations. But early on, HealthMatch started to spin out of control. Numerous reviews of the debacle indicate the state expanded the project scope twice. Project leaders underestimated the complexity of the work. The state's requirements were unclear. A sequence of corporate mergers roiled the contractor, which had significant quality problems and senior management turnover. David Kirchner did an analysis of the HealthMatch project for the Legislative Auditor's Office in 2007, and he says there was another big problem. Deadlines were wildly optimistic because the wrong people set them.
There was a sense that, you know, it needed to get done, and it needed to get done within a specific period of time. But then those decisions were being made by people at a very senior level who are not involved in building the system.
As deadlines passed, communication deteriorated, with both sides blaming each other for delays. By March 2008, Human Services Commissioner Cal Ludeman had had enough.
After many meetings, and I met the executives of the company and some of the technology folks, and I conferred with the chief information officer of the state, and I made a decision to just simply cancel the project.
But that wasn't the end. The company sued for breach of contract, and the state agreed to pay the company an additional $7.25 million to settle. Total cost? About $30 million. But former state senator Linda Berglund sees a major difference between MinSure and HealthMatch. HealthMatch never got off the ground.
Things we're seeing now with MinSure are things that we can see need to be fixed, but it isn't like the whole system isn't working at all.
But former Human Services Commissioner Cal Ludeman says the lesson to draw is not how to manage a big software project. He says the lesson is don't try to do electronic income verification. It's just too complicated.
Like trying to solve a Rubik's Cube while it is in flight.
The problem is both state and federal law require electronic income verification. Elizabeth Stowicki, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Minnesota Republican Party says it still has debt of more than $1 million. Tom Scheck has details.
The debt is significant as Republicans head into a critical election year where a U.S. Senate seat and five state constitutional offices, including governor, are on the ballot. But the state GOP finances are much better than a year ago. Party leaders announced they reduced the party's overall debt by $520,000 in 2013 after raising $2.5 million in total contributions. State Republican Party leaders were left scrambling at the end of 2011 when Tony Sutton resigned as chair. An internal audit found the party was nearly $2 million in debt. The Campaign Finance Board fined both Sutton and the state GOP for failing to properly disclose that spending. Party officials reorganized their staff, moved their headquarters, and ramped up fundraising to help cut the debt. Republican Party Chair Keith Downey said in a statement that the party is, quote, better positioned for the future. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Scientists are reporting new findings about changing water levels in the Great Lakes. In a paper being released today, researchers at a Michigan consulting firm say the role played by lake ice is more complex than previously believed. The ice doesn't simply act as a cap that limits evaporation in winter. It also cools lake temperatures and helps delay evaporation later. But heavy evaporation can occur shortly before ice forms. The other study by the University of Wisconsin says large-scale atmospheric patterns played a role in regular ups and downs of water levels until the late 1990s, when they began a drop for reasons that aren't clear. Authorities are investigating a death on the North Star commuter train tracks Monday night. Tim Nelson has more.
The Sherburne County Sheriff's Office says that a man was walking on the tracks near 192nd Avenue and Zebulon Street in Big Lake Township, just west of Elk River. The man was hit just before 5 p.m., and authorities say the gate arms at that intersection were down at the time when the train struck and killed the man. The train stopped a short time later. Passengers were taken by bus and other trains to their destinations. The Sheriff's Office, Elk River Police, the BNSF Railroad, the State Patrol, and Metro Transit all responded to the incident. It's the second time this month a pedestrian has been struck by a train and killed. A 62-year-old Minneapolis man walked in front of a light rail train at 42nd Street on January 12th. A North Star train struck and killed a railroad worker in Coon Rapids in 2010. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Authorities have identified two Allina Health ambulance workers who were seriously injured in a head-on crash with an SUV in Buffalo. The crash happened early Saturday morning. The head of Allina Health EMS identified the two as emergency medical technician Tim Daly of Albertville and paramedic Brian Nagel of Greenwood. Allina says the 43-year-old Daly helped at the scene despite significant leg injuries. He is at Buffalo Hospital and expects to spend up to 3 months in a wheelchair. The 30-year-old Nagel reportedly suffered severe head trauma. He was in critical condition at North Memorial Medical Center as of Monday. The sheriff's office says a patient in the ambulance is not believed to have been injured. This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Minnesota Congressman Keith Ellison used the Martin Luther King holiday celebration as an opportunity to renew his call for a boost to the minimum wage. Alex Friedrich has more.
During an event at the Minnesota History Center, the Minneapolis Democrats said stagnating wages and low-paid workers did not fit with King's idea of social equality.
Martin Luther King was for civil rights, there's no doubt about it, but he was also for economic justice, and the level of income inequality that we have today in many ways is literally worse than it was then.
Last month, Ellison wrote President Barack Obama asking him to order a pay raise for low-wage federal contract workers, and he supports proposed legislation that would raise the federal minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to $10.10 an hour and peg future increases to inflation. Alex Friedrich, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Speaking at the same event, Governor Mark Dayton told the crowd of around 800 people that inequality persists, and he called on individuals to change society.
We can choose a path of reaching out to those who are disadvantaged, who are cut off, who don't have hope and opportunity, or we can turn away in silence. We can reach out to stand up against injustice and the violence and hatred that still infects our society, or we can turn away with indifference.
The event speakers included both of Minnesota's U.S. senators and the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And finally, singing hymns while drinking beer might sound like an unusual church event, but a growing number of congregations are turning to the non-traditional approach to lure new members. A Fargo church group meets monthly in bars around town where they drink beer, sing traditional church songs, and socialize. Dan Gunderson attended a recent beer and hymns event at a Moorhead pub.
As people trickle into the basement meeting room, they gather around the small bar and order drinks.
And I'll try that chocolate porter.
Beer in hand, they grab a songbook and visit as they find seats around heavy wooden tables.
How's everybody doing today? All right. Everybody got a songbook?
Pastor Cody Schuler leads the hymn sing.
Number 13, softly and tenderly.
Undeterred by a sometimes cantankerous keyboard, the group of about 20 work their way through a list of favorite hymns while the bartender refreshes drinks and serves food.
Softly and tenderly, Jesus is calling, calling for you and for me.
Even if you don't know the hymn, you still have a good time and you learn it.
This is the third monthly beer and hymns event, and 31-year-old Jenny Erickson has attended all of them.
I think being able to enjoy a cocktail while enjoying hymns shows that it's okay and that spirituality and religion is not just straight and narrow. You can't have any fun. We want to enjoy our religion and our spirituality.
Beer and Hymns is sponsored by a small church that's supported by First United Methodist Church in Fargo. The church is simply called The Gathering. In addition to the monthly beer and hymns and other social events, they hold regular Sunday services in a theater. The group takes regular breaks from singing to visit. Pastor Schuler says there's no preaching, just singing and getting to know people over a beer.
Every time I come away having gotten to know somebody better than I did before, whether it's a new person or somebody that I've known for a long time. And so it really is, to me, what church really is, and that's community.
Schuler got the idea from a church in Denver. The idea is growing in popularity. There are beer and hymns events in the Twin Cities and in cities across the country. This is the first beer and hymns experience for friends Matt Boreen and Joe Ellison. They're young professionals from Fargo who grew up going to church, but want something other than traditional religion.
Your faith doesn't need to be confined within a church walls, or doesn't need to be void of the normal life that you would lead otherwise. So why not bring it into your everyday?
I like what you said, like meeting you where you are, and it's not necessarily having to fit into a dogmatic sort of idea, but you still get to enjoy the hymns that you sang when you were a child.
Cody Schuler has been a Methodist pastor for 12 years. He served traditional churches, but says he's now committed to a church experience where questions and doubts are as important as answers and faith. He's trying to reach people who've been turned off by church.
In my life, some of the meanest people that I have met are Christians, and can be very hurtful and damaging and give other Christians a bad name, give the church a bad name. And I've found a whole bunch of other people who have been wounded by church and said, let's do church differently. Let's create a place that's not just different for those who might be looking for something different, but a place where people can find redemption, people who can find healing and wholeness from their past church experiences.
Kay Weiss grew up in the church. Her dad was a Lutheran minister, but she drifted away from the church, starting in high school.
Because it wasn't something that I enjoyed. It wasn't something that I was interested in. It was boring. Stand up, sit down, hell and damnation, and I just wasn't digging it.
Weiss says she loves this non-traditional approach to worship, even though she knows many traditional churchgoers disapprove.
A lot of people say, oh, that doesn't really mix. I can't ever imagine anyone from our church going out and drinking together or something like that. But more than that, there are a lot of people that say, hey, you're 30-something getting involved in a church? Okay, if you want to have a beer while you're doing it, that's cool.
And that's the NPR News Update for Friday, January 21st. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Whoa.